Welcome to the Word Room. You're with Elizabeth Walton, speaking to Australian writers, talking about craft and writing. Trish Bolton, welcome to the Word Room and congratulations on a fantastic launch of your new novel, Whenever You're Ready. How's it all been going?
Oh, hi, Liz. Yes, well, it's been going really well. It's been a really busy time. It's settling down a little bit now because it's been out, my book has been out for about 4 weeks, but I've certainly enjoyed the last few weeks, enjoyed having the opportunity to talk about my book and the themes that are important to me.
Something that's really struck me is the title. Perhaps what I'm thinking is it's about choosing your own timing for when we end our life, like Leonard Woolf and Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you say about the title, because when you mention it now, it's just so obvious. Such an obvious conclusion to draw about the title. And yet I had thought of that title as more of an invitation. And I find myself often saying, whenever you're ready, and I'm not talking about my book at all. And it's sort of something that it's a phrase that we use so often, but I think it so perfectly sums up what you're talking about as far as thinking about the end of our lives.
Do you think we hang on too long, or is that something we can think about safely from the comfort of a younger age, but something that might change as we're confronted with those choices later in life?
I think in many cases that we do tend to prolong the inevitable, not just ourselves individually, but also people around us who love us. They don't want to let us go. And I think everybody's first impulse is to preserve life, to save life, to keep life going. But there does come a point when we need to let go, when the medical profession need to let go, and often they want to, but they feel compelled by the oath that they swore and the support that they want to give families. We need to support people as they get to that part of their lives to, if they want to end their lives, then I think they should be supported to do it.
Yeah, that's a big topic, isn't it? Do you think that we resuscitate as an act of love or as an act of selflessness or selfishness?
I think it's often an act of love, and I think sometimes, and it perhaps seems a very cruel thing to say, but it can be quite selfish because we really don't want to let that person go. And sometimes we really don't realise what their suffering is, particularly if they're in a hospital or in a nursing home and you're just visiting. You don't actually see the hour by hour, the hour experience of those people that whose lives are coming to an end. So when I say selfish, I think it's not intended to be that way, but it can turn out that way. And it is terribly hard to let go of somebody you love. And of course, sometimes people don't, there are those people too who will really want to fight on to the bitter end as well.
And that's understandable too. I think sometimes that these sorts of questions can be best addressed by thinking about curiosity and being open-minded towards what the person who is going through that experience is open to. I remember having a conversation with an aunt who was really distressed and facing some surgery, and she was quite elderly and quite frail, and in fact the surgery didn't go ahead, but she was, you know, I don't think anybody had actually asked her, do you want to say no to the surgery, because we're so sort of used to that idea of hanging on no matter what. But Trish, the fantastic thing I found in your book is that you address these topics with a great sense of humour. With things like it's in the little one-liners, like he thinks we've been let loose from the nursing home. Where do you get that sense of humour from, and how do you bring that into these really big, complex topics, do you think?
Well, yeah, when I'm writing about those sorts of, when I'm writing about life and death issues, I'm aware that these are heavy issues, that they're weighty issues. They're probably not issues that we would, or things that we would talk around at a dinner party. But they're important issues, and I think that we do need to talk about them. And I think fiction opens up that space. I think in storytelling, you can tell stories and explore issues that perhaps you otherwise can't. But I think also when you're thinking about those sort of things or writing about those sorts of issues, that it's important that there is some humour, that there's some reprieve for the reader. And also just to have a light moment as well. And because in life there's always light moments, and in life, even in our darkest moments, there is humour, there's black humour, and it's a survival mechanism. But I did want the reader to be able to take a breath, but I didn't go about wanting to, I didn't go about actually thinking, well, insert joke here. It was much more intuitive than that.
Yeah, that really comes across. Do you think that I think what you're doing there is actually making a space where you're actually normalizing some of the topics and making it, humor is such a great leveler, and it sort of invites everybody into the conversation, rather than sort of, I think it maybe overcomes a lot of prejudice and a lot of taboos. But I think also more than that, what you're doing is you're challenging the whole contemporary idea of what an older person is. Because the way you've presented it, the whole person, the sass, the dress, the style, everything is no different about that person to what it was at other ages. The makeup is no different, the hair's no different. So apart from the sort of inevitable health issues, and a person perhaps getting to a point where they can't care for themselves. Beyond that, what is age anyway, do you think?
Well, what is age and what is old? We are really who we have always been when we're older. Perhaps we're even more so who we've always been. And so we still enjoy the same things. We still have the same needs and desires. We still have the need to be valued. We still want our lives to be meaningful. We still like to, if we have liked to dress up and go out to the theatre, that's still what we like to do. None of that changes when you're old. You don't become some other person. You're just an older version of the people that you have always been.
And again, you pass that off with great humor when one of your characters sees herself in the mirror and says she thinks she could almost pass for 60, not 40, not 50, not 30, but 60, which I just thought was just a classic humor again. But you're also sort of moving into those areas of talking about needs. Okay, so what about sexuality? Because is that sort of almost a taboo as well, that we don't want to talk about sexuality and aging together? What do you say to that?
Oh, I think there's a really big taboo around sexuality and age. I mean, I know when I was much younger and I thought, are people in their 40s actually doing it? I thought that was just appalling. And I think when you're 40, you might think that about 60-year-olds or 70-year-olds. But of course, I think the time where image is just so important. We're used to seeing sex in terms of beautiful, youthful young bodies, not even just youthful, but beautiful young bodies, because they're the bodies that are going to make it into the advertisements and on TV and onto Instagram. But of course, sex isn't just reserved for beautiful young bodies or for youthful young bodies. It's for everybody. And, trigger warning, older people flirt. Trigger warning, older people have sex. Older people fall in love. They dance, they do all the things that people of any age who are in love do.
Even there, you've gone into humor, because like the idea that we need a trigger warning to warn people that older people flirting is a real thing. I really
It's
do.
actually that sort of ew word, isn't it? Like, if you know, if people think about older people having sex or old people, whatever age that is, because it's all relative. It just seems to be such a response to it and such a surprise that people of older age are having sex. But of course, they've been together. Some of them may have been together for a very long time. Some may have just come together. And I'm not going to say because they're in love, because I don't think sex always has to be as a result of love, but they're together, they care about each other. Of course, they're going to have sex.
One of the things that you're also talking about is authenticity. And I'm noticing that readers reflecting on your book are finding their ordinary lives are in the pages, perhaps a little like Sally Rooney's novels. Beyond that sort of Instagram performance element that's snuck into all of our lives, you seem to get under the skin of ordinary experiences rather than hyper-realized experiences. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I really wanted to write about the real lives of real people. Obviously, you know, people in fiction, I think I've said this before, that homo fictus, you know, their lives are much more dramatic and much more extraordinary. And even when they're boring, they're being more boring than ordinary people. But within that framework, I did want to write about what I felt were ordinary lives. So the detail and the everyday of ordinary lives. And although a couple of my characters have had, you know, quite exciting, I guess, demanding careers, their lives are fairly much lives that we can relate to. And certainly their relationships are relationships that we can relate to, with all their joys and vexations, I suppose, and disappointments. And so I wanted those people to appear on the page. I didn't want them to be immensely wealthy, unless there was a point for that wealth. I didn't want them to be, you know, terribly hip or terribly cool or any of those things, just because most of us are not those things. And, yeah, I just wanted to write about the stuff of everyday life, because within that is a lot of drama. There's more drama than most of us can manage, really, some of the time. So that's who I wanted to put on the page and explore those lives and say those lives are interesting too, just as interesting as a celebrity's life, perhaps way more interesting actually. So
Because you're getting the non-homogenized version as opposed to the manufactured version of a celebrity life. But I mean, what about friendships? Because, you know, marriages start and fail or whatever, but sometimes those friendships are there throughout the duration. How do we mend the rifts in lifelong friendships that might take years to erupt? Can you talk to us about that and what you also describe as the nature of forgiveness?
Yeah, I think women's friendships are particularly interesting because they're often very, very passionate, especially in their early stages. It's almost like you're almost like lovers. It's so intense. And often there are friendships that, lifelong friendships that perhaps you don't have very much in common anymore, but you have the past in common. Mm-hmm. And that past is very important to you. And you know each other from that past. And that's someone who's known you since you were very young. And you've known that person since you were very young. And that's not something to give up easily. But sometimes friendships do come to an end. And I've seen a few stories in the media about that recently, and people writing that in the end they're sort of able to let go, but there's a sadness there, but also still an affection.
Something you also refer to in your book and draw on is that the ever-present presence of Instagram. You've got these situations where people are comparing their lives and increasingly filtering their lives through Instagram. What do you think the difference is between competing with the yummy mummies for inspiration as compared to, say, being crushed by appearances and having to perform for our grid-worthy moments? Do you have something to say to that?
I think it would be very easy to be crushed if you're constantly comparing yourself to others, and you just have to remind yourself, yeah, that's their life on the screen, that's their life in that tile for that moment. But, you know, they may look that way, but off they go to clean the toilet or off they go to have an argument with their partner, you're just seeing a little tiny very curated portion of their lives. So yeah, it's a very fine line, and I think we have to all be aware of it. And if we've got certain tendencies in ourselves, to be aware of that if we're constantly online, and what that might mean to our sort of emotional well-being.
Especially since, you know, the internet doesn't forget. I feel for young people sometimes these days that might sort of say something as a teenager, and then, you know, that sort of shows up in a job interview or something where someone's researched what they might have said 10 years ago in a former sense of themselves, and there doesn't seem to be a space for allowing people to grow up. Having said that, that doesn't excuse people's very strange things that they've done that have been in the media recently as well. But what do you think about the idea of the bad girl? Your character Alice is described as a problem that can't be solved. Have you ever been the bad girl, Trish?
No, I don't really think I have. I may have had a couple of years there where I went a little wild, but no, I have always been very responsible. I was the oldest of four children, and I was expected to take quite a lot of responsibility for those children because my mother worked then, and very few mothers worked then. And I was married very young. And so I never really had that time, that sort of freedom that you have as a, you know, that teenagers have. So I did break out a little bit for a couple of years, sort of in my early 30s, but really the timing wasn't right. And, I quickly sort of, when I say, you know, I really didn't do anything wild or crazy, but for me, it was a time where I sort of rejected a whole lot of things. And I started going to university then, so it was a very new life for me that I enjoyed. But I think in the character Alice, although perhaps, you know, her life hasn't turned out quite as successfully as she had hoped, her career, she had the courage to try and live a creative life. And I think if I had my time over again, I would love to have that courage. And I would love to have lived a creative life and shunned many of the things that she shunned. And she also didn't conform to gender expectations. She also really shunned the idea of marriage. And, and she had paid quite dearly for those choices, I think, as many creative people do, especially in this country where there's very little support for creative people.
Yeah, I think... it's very difficult, I think, for especially young people coming up now to get into creative life where the economic pressures are just so immense. And even escaping to the regions isn't a solution anymore, which it might have been for, I think, when I was growing up. I mean, I certainly did that myself, like get out of the city, get a cheaper lifestyle, buy time to, you know, do your creative work if that's what it takes. But that doesn't seem to even be an option anymore. But sticking with Alice, you know, she also seems to me to have a creative response to death, because I thought that she sort of processed death almost like a moment from a Byron Katie book, where the people who've passed away aren't really gone. They're just in another room and out of sight. And she's sort of tenderly approaching death and grief that way until someone she loves very dearly crashes through the moment and says, "Come on, Alice, we're not at a seance," and sort of pulls her up and with the stark reality of what death really is, from a different perspective. Do you think these are both valid responses to processing departures, and both unexpected and inevitable? Do you have something to say to that?
Yeah, look, I don't think there's any one way to approach or to feel about death or to manage the loss of someone. And I think Alice is very tender-hearted, very generous with her friendship. I'm very supportive of her friends. And I think that she, and I think many of us, feel the presence of people that we've lost. And I think for her too, it's also a way of sort of managing her grief, because I know she does feel the presence of a little boy that was lost in the story as well, when she stays in his home. And I think for many of us, the I think the people that we've loved and lost are really always with us.
Yeah, I have that sense too. Yeah, that's a beautiful, beautiful place to bring this conversation to a natural close. Trish, thank you so much for your tender-hearted and generous writing. You mentioned those words about Alice, but I would say that they equally apply to you in your beautiful writing and storytelling. Thank you for joining us today, Trish.
Oh, thank you, Liz. It's just been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.